Before Mabbott could refuse, he became aware of activity, of dark figures emerging from the shadows, briefly catching the light, then disappearing again. Somewhere a door opened and closed with the merest sigh. Christina looked tired. Oddly enough, what little light there was around the table shone obliquely on her, accentuating the Madonna-like combination of oval face, long straight dark hair with touches of grey, high cheekbones, and the wide, thin-lipped mouth he knew so well.
Rex and I are...
She had to clear her throat before carrying on.
Going to New York on Sunday.
From nowhere, a crisply hissing champagne flute appeared beside him, and there was a momentary lull as the other glasses were refilled around the table. Rex Naismith seemed quite unembarrassed by the situation. He beamed at Mabbott, thanked the waiter, and raised his glass.
Cheers!
Mabbott mumbled. Christina barely raised her glass. Rex drank appreciatively, rolling the champagne round his mouth before setting down his glass.
Christina tells me you're a writer. I admire anyone who can write. I come up with the odd speech or two, but not the imaginative stuff.
Like a chess player before a big game, Mabbott had rehearsed his moves on the way there, but the one thing he hadn't prepared for was amiability. He nodded, intending to look blank, but it came out as surly.
"What the fuck are you doing with my wife?"
is what he really wanted to say.
"It's never easy,"
is what he actually said.
"I know quite a few chaps who are harbouring little masterpieces. And, of course, dear old Cloudesley Marshall actually had one published. It was a thriller, very James Bond, lots of sex, which is something one wouldn't normally associate with Cloudesley. He used to run the Boy Scouts."
Mabbott felt like a rabbit caught in headlights. Bereft of a strategy to make them talk about what they should surely be talking about, he could only listen. Christina, Polish and practical, took refuge in arrangements.
"We shall be in New York for some time. Then we go to Ottawa."
Rex grimaced.
"Frightful place. Bloody cold, and all the buildings look like elephant turds. But we're supposed to be nice to Canada these days. All sorts of things brewing. Know about the Athabasca tar sands?"
Mabbott nodded. Here was something he did know about. Once.
"I was an energy correspondent." "Well, then, you probably know far better than me what's going on there. Millions of dollars being spent buggering up the place. Environmentalists up in arms, and quite rightly, too. But they're passing an awful lot of business our way. We still have a lot of mining expertise, and thankfully it's appreciated out there. Anyway, I have to go and make sure we're being nice to everybody and not letting Hamish Melville do the rain dance on them."
Mabbott looked up sharply.
"Hamish Melville? How does he come into it?" "Well, you know Hamish. Everyone knows Hamish. If there's a pie, his finger will be in it somewhere."
Christina frowned and asked,
"Isn't he some kind of unofficial ambassador? Goes where the government don't go?"
Rex raised his eyebrows.
"Oh, Hamish is as Hamish is portrayed. A super chap, but he doesn't always have the bigger picture in mind."
"How do you mean?" asked Mabbott.
"Well, he has his own agenda. The tar sands aren't absolutely unpopulated, and in the northwest, by the Yanahook River, there's a group of bods called the Sahalas. Indians, First Nations, they call them now. Not that many of them, and a lot seem quite happy to go and work in the casinos in Calgary. But there's a hardcore that money won't shift. These people are like a magnet to Hamish, and he's been up there, well, how can I put it, advising them of their rights."
This riled Mabbott. "That's fair enough, isn't it, if it's their land?"
"Well, in theory, yes."
"It's their moral right."
"You know, forgive me, but I've had this argument with Hamish many times. Yes, these people have rights, but there's an awful lot of land and very few of them living on it. Our view is that they can still lead decent lives, uninterfered with, on part of the land, and let the rest be, developed. That way everyone benefits and they get a damn decent royalty for their people."
Mabbott took another sip of what was, even in his limited experience, a very fine champagne.
"You know Hamish Melville, then?" "Inasmuch as anyone knows Hamish, yes."
Rex drank rather delicately, thought Mabbott, for a big man.
Long ago, in the mists of time, I had the privilege of representing the people of Bletchley and South Beds in Her Majesty's Parliament. I travelled a bit and spoke a couple of languages, so I found myself a comfortable little spot in the FCO, a Foreign and Commonwealth Office, as it then was.
Mabbott was aware of Christina adjusting her position, looking quickly from one of them to the other, and he knew that she was willing the conversation on, as if this shared interest might help them avoid confrontation. Rex smoothed a corner of the tablecloth.
At that time, we're talking nearly 20 years ago now, Hamish was on the payroll, roving brief sort of thing. He'd a background in the military and the city, not an unusual combination, and of course he had this wicked charm. So,
at Rex's almost subliminal nod, more champagne appeared from the gloom.
He became most useful to us in a number of delicate situations. Hostage talks, raids on installations, that sort of thing. He was very successful, a sort of latter-day T.E. Lawrence. Major, John Major, that is, wanted to bring him into government. Quite high up, too, but Hamish wasn't interested. He wasn't political in any way, and quite possibly because of that he began to pull away from anything official. Rarely came back to the country, and from what one could tell, he began to use what he'd learnt in a more, well, international sphere. In 97, I lost my seat, which was quite a relief, to be honest. My wife died the same year, which was also quite a relief.
His delivery was finely paced, assured. This was a man who was used to being listened to.
So, quite suddenly, at the grand old age of 59 and a half, I found myself footloose and fancy-free. Like a lot of Tories who got the push in 97, I picked up a few directorships, dabbled in hedge funds, all sorts of wickedness, and also went back to my first love, which was poodling round the globe. Every now and then our paths will cross, usually in some bar or at a friend's place. Hamish avoided embassies like the plague. He sort of went native, but he always knew exactly what he was doing.
Which was?
Helping people everyone else ignored, basically, and making a fair nuisance of himself in the process.
Which he's still doing,
as far as I know.
Rex looked across at Christina. This time it was more than a glance. An unhurried look of unmistakable warmth. He lightly, affectionately, took her hand, and with the other summoned a waiter from the shadows.
"Stay for a bite with us," he said.
It was the touch of her hand as much as the us that hit Mabbott hard.
No, I won't. Thank you.
He pushed back his chair and stood up. Aware he'd done so rather too quickly, Mabbott took care placing it neatly beneath the table. Anything to avoid looking at Christina. Rex, too, stood and held out his hand.
"I'm glad we've met."
Mabbott nodded. He wanted to speak, but found himself unable to. The two men shook hands, and Mabbott turned, his eyes passing over Christina's without engaging. He located the exit and walked down the mirrored corridor that led him to the entrance. He pulled hard at the heavy black door like a man trying to escape a fire. Only when he pushed did the door swing open and release him into the street. And it was there, on the corner of Furness Gardens and Fulham Road, that a tsunami of self-pity swept over him. Tears came, pathetic, unbidden and unstoppable. Two special constables strolled by and, seeing him, looked quickly away. The 43 bus dropped him on the corner of Lodge Street, a 5-minute walk from the house. Mabbott fumbled for his keys, far too many on the ring, and pushed open the front door. The hallway was dark, but he could see a sliver of light beneath the kitchen door and hear voices. He switched on the hall light and clattered about a bit, hanging his coat up, but he still made Jay and Shiraz jump apart when he entered the kitchen. It seemed innocent enough. They were just close, not doing anything. Jay was all brittle brightness.
"Hello, Dad. We've just made some food."
"Sausages?"
Shiraz looked at Jay, concerned until he saw her break into a smile.
"I promise, Dad, I'll get some tomorrow. Great big thick beefy venison, pork, sage, everything you like. But you can cook them."
"Can't wait."
"I have something now. Shiraz has made carrot and yogurt soup, and it's delicious."
No, I've already eaten,"
Mabbott lied, "and I've some work to do." He looked from Jay to Shiraj. Shiraj put his hand to his heart.
Thank you, sir, for allowing me into your home.
Mabbott nodded. Good night, all.
Dad?
Jay's voice made him jump. He was at his writing table, in a halo of halogen, bent over his work, miles away from the world.
Hi, love. How are you?
She came across to him. He felt her arms resting lightly on his shoulder.
I'm fine. How are you?
Without turning, he reached for her hand.
I saw your mother tonight.
I know, she called.
Met him. Tyrannosaurus Rex.
And what did you think?
I liked him.
Yes, I liked him.
Then something gave again, and for the second time that evening emotion got the better of him.
I liked him, Jay. That's the bloody trouble. I liked him.
Mabbott raised both hands up to hers.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry, Dad. I really am. Don't be sorry. She's happy. He's a nice guy. You're happy. He's a nice guy. I'll get over it.
It took him two or three deep breaths before he regained control. His daughter squeezed his shoulders, and they were silent for a while. When he composed himself, Mabbott leant forward and adjusted the screen in front of him.
Is your novel, Dad?
No, it's just some info on someone.
Jay peered at the screen.
Hamish Melville.
You know him?
Of course, Dad. I'm not completely stupid.
I thought he'd be a little out of your age range.
Melville, he was a hero at school, fighting the big boys, siding with the locals, tramping off into the middle of nowhere. He won a Year 6 debate for who they'd most like to see running the country. Why are you looking him up?
Someone's asked me to write a book about him.
A book about Hamish Melville?
Yes.
Wow, that's fantastic, Dad. They're going to pay you?
Oh, yes. Quite a lot.
Are you going to do it?
Mabbott leant back, rubbed his eyes and stared at the screen.
I don't know. I don't know what I'm getting myself into. I keep telling myself that all I really want to do is write my novel. That's what's new and exciting. Then I talk to you and Shiraj and even bloody Rex, and the whole thing suddenly seems, I don't know, intriguing.
Intriguing?
Mabbott grinned and shook his head.
The publishing company's keen, but I don't trust them. And Melville hates journalists.
He gave a bleak smile.
Bad man wants book written. Good man doesn't want book written. It's the sort of thing that makes the ears prick up.
So what's stopping you?
I don't know exactly. You, Sam, the family. It's a tight deadline and will mean my going away again, if I do it properly.
Mabbott sighed.
I've been away too long, too often.
Your mother's right. I've been bad at being a father and bad at being a husband. I've got to put some time in. Make some repairs. Jay squeezed his hand and giggled.
Dad, you sound like the odd job man.
Despite himself, Mabbott laughed at this. The odd job man was a part of family folklore, a character they'd met on holiday in the Lake District, who had a compulsive need to fix things. He was constantly under tables and up small ladders, taking perfectly efficient things apart and putting them back together again. One day his wife revealed that he was having treatment for the condition in Preston, but long before that, his place in the pantheon of Mabbott family heroes was assured.
Seriously, you're like Sam.
Mabbott frowned.
Me? Like Sam?
You're both really good at what you do, but you're always the last to see it.
He smiled.
Have we got a picture of him?
Sam?
No, the odd job man. I'd like to see him again.
I'll have a look. There must be one somewhere.
And they both laughed at the memory, a shared laugh, unreserved, and for a moment at least, infectious. Mabbott lay awake into the small hours. Another sleepless night that had started with too much unhealthy imagining of Christina with Rex began to refocus around Melville, the book, and something Shiraj had said. Something about too many good people making up stories, as if it were a waste of their talents. Mabbott knew he could do the book and do it bloody well. So what, exactly, was stopping him? Was it just the suspiciously large amount of money he was being offered? He sat up, switched on the light, then he switched it off again. He could think more clearly in the dark. When it really came down to it, what was bugging him about the Melville book was not its subject, but the crass way Ron Latham was approaching it, thinking he could achieve anything with his checkbook. Melville was a sophisticated operator. This project would need intelligence rather than wads of cash to find the man behind the smoke screens. As Mabbott chased these thoughts around his head, he became more and more convinced that things could be different if he were to take the initiative in the hunt for Melville. He knew about tenacity. He'd won an award for it once. He also knew that the way to crack a story was not unlike the way detectives approach a crime. To catch Melville, one would have to use Melville's own tactics. Go underground. Work below the radar. If he were free to do it his way, then he could make the book work. The alarm clock showed 2:30, where Mabbott finally gave up the struggle to sleep, and pulling on the dressing gown Christina had given him for the last birthday they'd spent together, he sat down at his computer to plot a guerrilla strategy. Over the next 2 hours, he tried to pick out the likely trouble spots that Melville might be drawn to, bearing in mind the issues on which the man was known to hold strong views. There was no shortage of ideas. If it was indigenous people threatened by development that attracted him, then Melville could be almost anywhere in the world. In Papua New Guinea, 312 local tribes, some as yet uncontacted, were sitting on resources that the Indonesian government, backed up by their army, was determined to extract. In Botswana, the Kalahari Bushmen were being denied access to their wells, or simply being driven off their land to make way for a $3 billion diamond mine. There were issues over oil extraction in the Peruvian jungle, titanium in Kenya, copper smelting in India, diamonds in Zimbabwe, hydroelectric schemes in Brazil, even beauty spots in Shropshire threatened by coal mining. Mabbott scanned endless websites which tracked revelations about global greed. Forest Watch, Tribal Information Forum, Freedom to Know, Hate Oil, Leave Us Alone, Protect or Die, God Watch, the Danish Women's Environmental Action Group. By dawn, his eyes were stinging, but a plan of action was beginning to form in his mind. He showered and made himself an early breakfast. Toast, a bowl of fruit, and strong coffee. He took his second cup upstairs. There was no sound from either of the other two bedrooms. Pushing his door to, he sat at his desk and dialed Scylla's number. She sounded husky and defensive.
Scylla Cordwell.
I'll do it. For some reason, this led to a prolonged attack of coughing at the other end.
Now you tell me. Latham's just left on a plane to Sydney, for Christ's sake.
Doesn't matter. All I need is travel expenses, and for Ron to stay in Sydney for as long as possible. Chapter 10. Sam Mabbott was tall and took after his mother in looks, with jet-black hair and strong cheekbones. Girls loved him, not so much for his cheekbones, as for the soft, shy sadness of his eyes. He had a slightly wavering voice, which he saw as a drawback and others saw as distinctive. Though Sam had an uncomfortable relationship with his father, he was glad to have been born the son of a writer and took this obligation seriously. For the last year, Sam and two other young men had been writing plays and poems under the collective name of No Hope Theatre, and it was their latest work that was being given its world premiere in a private room above the Dark Lady pub in Chiswell Street. All the family had turned out, including, Mabbott noticed, both mother and father. Christina may have been here out of maternal affection, but Mabbott was here out of duty and guilt. He had little time for No Hope's repertoire, but if he was going to be wrapped up in the Melville project, this might be his last chance of seeing his awkward, prickly son for a while.
"Ass," intoned a voice from the blackness, pretty much on the dot of 8:30. "Ass that illuminates the world."
A chord rang out. A single key light hit Sam's curled-up figure as it lay whimpering on the floor. Fake shit fell from the ceiling onto the audience. For what seemed an interminable amount of time, Sam's character engaged with various threatening figures, both verbally and visually. It was a bravura performance, but Mabbott found that his mind kept wandering, and despite his best efforts, his eyes gently closing. In the second half, fan heaters were turned on as the action of arse transported the audience to a Turkish jail. Mabbott felt uncomfortable for Shiraj, but the boy was watching with rapt attention, his fingers locked in Jay's. At the end, Mabbott had a moment or two with his son. Sam, who had an awkward habit of never opening a conversation, flicked the hair from his eyes and gave his father an ironic or possibly just uncertain smile.
"You were great, but occasionally..." "You don't have to say anything, Dad. I know you don't do polemic."
"You stick to your guns. I admire that. You don't try to please everybody." Sam nodded towards the departing audience.
"We seem to please most people here."
With Sam, free speech was a one-way thing. The truth was that apart from one or two loners lured up from the bar by the title, 90% of Arse's audience consisted of friends and family of the cast. At that moment, Christina, obviously in a hurry, squeezed between them. She kissed her son with an unequivocal warmth that irritated Mabbott, as if she were the only one who understood him.
"Fantastic! You boys are so good! Meet you downstairs?"
She cupped Sam's pale cheeks in both hands, kissed him again, and with a wave turned and headed for the door. Mabbott watched her go, then gave his son a brief hug.
"Must get together soon. I'll think of something. Give you a call."
He caught up with Christina as she hurried down the stairs. A cold draught blew in from the half-open fire exit.
"Drink?" he asked.
She paused, looked rather severely at him for a moment, then, as he held the door open, walked past him into the bar.
"White wine spritzer?"
As if he needed to ask. It had been her drink of choice for 30 years. He'd rather hoped that Rex might have educated her palate. The bar was crowded and noisy, as these places always were. He put the drink in front of her and pulled up a stool. For a moment it felt like old times. It was something they always used to do, and he smiled at the memory. They had once made each other happy.
"What's that?"
She pointed accusingly at his glass, as if it might be evidence of infidelity.
"A large scotch."
"Since when?"
"Since I saw Arse."
"It was great."
"No, it wasn't."
"Sam and the boys told me they wrote it in a week."
"Felt like it," he said, irritated less by her opinion than by her assumption of inside information.
"It was strong stuff."
"It was repulsive. Be honest."
Christina shrugged.
"What were you expecting, Mary Poppins?"
"I don't see why I should have to take responsibility for the Armenian genocide, that's all."
"Not you, us."
"No Rex tonight?"
"He's at the Mansion House."
"Underground station?"
"No, the Mansion House, for the Lord Mayor's dinner."
Christina sipped her spritzer, but having established a points victory, she softened.
"'Twas good of you to come last night. I know it can't have been easy for you, to meet Rex."
There was a pause.
"What am I supposed to say, Chris? That he's a better man than me?"
Surprisingly, Christina put out her hand and touched his arm.
"Don't be stupid. He's different, that's all."
"Rich, witty, well-connected?"
She shook her head dismissively. Mabbott smiled.
"And that's just me."
She laughed, a quick, defenseless laugh. Such a rare thing between them these past few years. It was like striking a match in a darkened room.
"I wanted to let you know I've taken on a book. Something I didn't tell you about. It's well paid, but it does mean I shall be away travelling again."
"That's good, isn't it?"
"Is it?"
Christina looked at him carefully.
"What are you trying to say, Keith?"
"Come back."
She shook her head and looked away.
"Come back. Before it's too late."
"Don't be silly. We both know it won't work."
"Only one of us knows."
Keith, I am saying this once and for all. We parted for good. We agreed. Rex wants to marry me. I want to marry him. If you respect me, let me go. We can still be friends. And he likes you. He got on well with you.
Mabbott finished the whiskey in one fierce gulp and thumped his glass down on the table.
Thanks, but I'm not taking that bait. If you want an endorsement from me, forget it. He's yours, not mine. He may love me like a brother, but to tell you the truth, I'd be happier if I never saw him again in my life.
Chapter 11. In retrospect, it had been a foolish thing to say, thought Mabbott, as Rex approached, shook his hand, and settled himself at the table of a discreet Italian restaurant on the corner of Horseferry Road. It had taken a few days for Scylla to sort out the details with Latham. She had, she said, managed quite cleverly to present her client's indecision, bordering on ingratitude, as nothing more than a weighing up of two major offers, without, of course, admitting that not a cent had been committed to the novel by any publisher. They had then moved on to Mabbott's concerns over research and his insistence that he be able to plan his own moves. Latham had argued that he was paying, and it was up to him to call the tune. He had already begun to assemble a team of bright young graduates to help with research. Scylla got him to agree that they would remain London-based, leaving Mabbott free to track down Melville abroad. Latham replied that he personally would lead the team and make relevant inquiries as to Melville's movements, ensuring that Mabbott had somewhere to start. Mabbott had told Scylla that this was absolutely not acceptable, whereupon she finally blew up, gave him a lecture about gratitude, opportunity, unselfishness and other priorities. The contract was finally signed at her office late one evening over a takeaway curry. Mabbott was then faced with the unpalatable fact that sitting at the top of the list of those personal contacts he could call on to begin his search for Melville was his wife's new lover. He had swallowed this bitter pill, along with a hefty dose of pride, and had written to Rex Naismith in confidence, outlining his plans and requesting any advice he might have. Within a few days, Rex had come back with one or two bites and suggested that they meet up. Mabbott had been the first to arrive at the modest trattoria, 5 minutes' walk from Parliament Square. A few moments after he'd sat down, Rex loomed through the door, to be met cordially by the portly owner, with whom he engaged in some prolonged and convivial banter, in Italian, before handing him his coat and proceeding to the table. He shook Mabbott's hand and smiled apologetically.
"Hope you don't mind coming down to my neck of the woods."
"It's fine." Mabbott, wrong-footed by Rex's incorrigible politeness, sounded unconvincing.
"Christina tells me that you both saw Sam's play. Bottom?"
"Arse, actually." Rex leant back, laughing generously.
"She enjoyed it very much."
"Yes, she did," was all Mabbott could think of to say.
"Thank you for seeing me."
Rex waved this away.
"Not at all. I'm on a committee for interdepartmental efficiency savings, so any interruption is to be grasped with both hands."
"When we last met, you said that you knew Hamish Melville." Rex nodded. Mabbott noted, with obscure satisfaction, that his companion was a little out of breath.
"And you tell me you're writing a book about him?"
"It's all rather hush-hush."
"Of course."
A waiter hove into view.
"A drink to start with, sir?"
Rex beamed happily.
"A glass of wine could be my saviour. What about you?"
"Fine.
Bottle of the house red."
As the waiter went away, Rex explained his choice of restaurant. It was small, family-run, and so unobtrusive and unpretentious that it was popular with politicians who appreciated privacy, which was why it was always busy. Mabbott took a quick look around.
"Except today," added Rex. "They're still in recess."
The waiter returned, and Rex tried the wine.
"Not bad. Italian farmyard. Nothing complicated."
With a quick nod from Rex, the waiter poured two glasses and left the bottle on the table.
"So, how can I be of help? The book sounds interesting."
except that my publisher is a control freak. His idea of helping me is to gather up a team of previously unemployed media studies graduates who are supposed to be out there gaining me access. But as I told you in my letter, that is not how I like to work. It seems to be the perfect way of alerting the entire world to the fact that the hunt is on, which is why I wanted to talk to you.
Rex raised his glass.
Good health.
Mabbott responded awkwardly. They were not meant to be friends.
Your instinct is absolutely correct,
Rex went on.
Hamish is notoriously touchy about privacy. I don't know the exact details, but they say that there are only a half dozen people he trusts. Like him, they're all highly educated, multilingual, and totally loyal. Beyond that, there is a sort of sleeping network of sympathizers he can mobilize in pretty much any country in the world. Many are just locals, but Melville always makes sure they have access to state-of-the-art communications. A barefoot army with laptops. Breaking into his network isn't going to be easy. Certainly not by conventional means.
Rex picked up the menu.
Shall we order?
They both went for the special. Rex was expected back at his committee, and Mabbott was aware that already that morning he'd had two messages from Latham, fresh back from Australia. Rex broke the end off a bread roll.
I gather from Christina that you earned your spurs on the investigative front. Some award, she tells me.
Does she? And what else? Mabbott thought to himself. Oh, yes, I was a big star 15 years ago.
How so?
Got a tip-off that arsenic waste was being dumped in a river in the Midlands. Worked my way through the evidence. Couldn't find anything. Company with unblemished record. Then a child died. Not even in the area. In a village miles away, in what used to be Westmoreland. By pure coincidence, I was tracking through company records one last time when I came across the name Saxelby, which rang a bell. It was the same name as the boy who died. I followed it up, found that he'd died of liver malfunction. Odd in a boy of 12 who was previously healthy. Turned out that before his parents split up, he lived right beside the stream that drained from the factory. That was the link I needed. After that, it was all down to chemical testing. Bingo. Arsenic sulfide discharges over a period of 3 months. The company knew about it, but hushed it up. And that child wasn't the only casualty. Rex nodded as he listened.
That must have been a damn good feeling. I mean, to nail the buggers.
Mabbott smiled. Yes, it was a good feeling.
Then what?
Nothing like that ever came my way again. Within the industry, there were those who felt I'd been underhand.
And had you?
I paid some money from my paper to the boy's mother to get access to his medical records. It was more or less the only way of getting at the truth, but it meant that, in addition to my British Gas Award, I was given a bollocking by the Press Commission. And journalism being the business it is, that was what most people remembered. Their food had arrived. 2 plates of linguine, gently steaming.
And since then?
I worked on whatever came along. A bit of ghostwriting, editing, then company commissions to pay the bills. Sleeping with the enemy, you could say.
So when this Melville book came up?
I was surprised, to say the least. Still am. Great subject, good money. Just difficult people to deal with. Mabbott felt comfortable with Rex, and there was no longer much point in fighting it. In fact, Rex was the first person he'd been able to talk to like this for a very long time. He smiled ruefully.
I was toying with not doing it at all. There is another project I really want to do.
Ah, the science fiction story.
Historical recreation.
Yes, Christina's told me about it.
Mabbott's ears pricked up. And? For once, Rex was hesitant.
She thinks that of the two, you're better off going with the non-fiction.
For a while, they both ate. An American family came in. Mother, father, grandmother, 2 teenage children, all identical, apart from their age and gender. They stood there awkwardly, the grown-ups debating among themselves, while the 2 children looked back at the door. Rex sat back, then dabbed the sides of his mouth before laying his napkin to one side. He regarded Mabbott thoughtfully for a moment, then leant forward and dropped his voice.
"I've talked to a few people since I got your message. It's all right, I gave no names. And I have it on pretty good authority that Hamish is currently in the subcontinent. There's something brewing there which sounds completely up his street. Big industry, local tribes. Very much Hamish's stamping ground. I still have a vested interest in knowing what he's up to, but you'll understand that I can't be seen to be betraying confidences. I'm still too close to Westminster."
Mabbott nodded. Rex checked his watch.
"Talking of which, time flies."
He finished another mouthful, pushed his plate to one side, then reached inside his pocket and handed Mabbott an envelope.
"You'll find a key and an address in there. When you go, be sure to take some ID, passport, driver's license. All the details I could find will be in there waiting for you. Sorry about the George Smiley bit, but I have to be seen as fragrant."
He smiled encouragingly.
"I hope it'll help you find him. All I can say is move fast, because you can be sure he'll move a lot faster."
"Thanks, Rex.
And, Keith, my name must be kept out of this completely."
"Why are you helping me?"
"I was a friend of the old bugger. I admire him. I think he's an unsung hero. And we're short of heroes these days."
Rex left with a jaunty farewell, as if they were old school chums who just enjoyed a reunion. Mabbott paid the bill and took a bus to St. John's Wood. Following Rex's instructions, he found a long, low building which looked as if it might at one time have been the property of the nearby church. Now there were iron grills over the lancet windows, and a large sign had been stuck outside the arched doorway, bearing the name of the Capital Storage Company. At reception, Mabbott identified himself using his driver's license. A door automatically opened, and he followed an elderly man with a limp down a passageway to an open area flanked by strongbox vaults. The custodian retired, and with the key Rex had given him, Mabbott opened one of the strongboxes. Inside was a white A4 envelope with his name on it. He signed the relevant forms, and slipping the envelope into his shoulder bag, he took the 274 bus and headed home. Mabbott sat in his workroom at Resserton Road. Open in front of him were various documents, names, addresses, street maps, and beside them the Times World Atlas that his father had invested in using some of his retirement money, and which, in the end, he'd never used. Mabbott barely lifted his head until his phone buzzed almost an hour later. It was a text message from Ron Latham, confirming that Melville had been located, as suspected, in northern Brazil. But Mabbott's finger was elsewhere. Tracing the course of the Mahanadi River as it snaked its way through the eastern Ghats and out into the Bay of Bengal.
Part 2. The Solution. Chapter 1. Mabbott sniffed the air with satisfaction. Biju Pitnaik Airport at Bhubaneswar, ancient capital of Kalinga, was a pleasant surprise. Gone was the fuzzy disorientation he'd felt as he was processed off the London flight in the glass and steel trussed anonymity of Delhi. Here in Bhubaneswar, cosseted by a warm, damp breeze off the Bay of Bengal, disembarking passengers walked from the aircraft to the terminal through a garden of low, clipped hedges and well-tended flower beds. In among these were set terracotta figures of the better-known deities, Ganesh the elephant, Hanuman the monkey, Shiva and Vishnu. The garden led to a small, friendly arrivals hall, hung with lanterns and brightly coloured banners, as if for a festival. Mabbott took up position beside the baggage belt. Above him, a brightly lit 10-metre advertising panel depicted a family, all of whom, from baby to aged grandparents, were looking dreamily heavenwards, smiling identical happy smiles. Below them, picked out in silver lettering, ran the strap line, "Dalween Banking, for a better India." Mabbott stared down at the inert rubber strip, as if willpower alone might set it in motion. Some of the overlapping slats were half peeled away, revealing piles of rubbish beneath.
a discarded shoe, plastic bags, stained newspapers, something dark and amorphous, its damp sheen reflecting the neon above. Craning his neck, he looked towards the exit, trying to pick out the man who was supposed to be meeting him among the crowd of expectant faces squeezed up against a steel barrier. Several khaki-uniformed policemen stood around, lathis in hand. Mabbott considered his options. Provided the baggage arrived, and his was amongst it, and provided his man was there to meet him, then he could go to work immediately, following up the leads he'd been given. The only cloud on the horizon was the oppressive presence of Ron Latham. Even from 5,000 miles away, Mabbott could still picture the calculating stare with which Latham had fixed him as they had said their farewells in London. Latham knew that Mabbott had not told him everything about the contacts that had led him to India, and he knew that Mabbott knew he knew, hence this cat-and-mouse game, with Latham ostensibly allowing Mabbott to conduct his own investigation while insisting on organising the flights and hotel and requesting that the hotel provide a guide. Scylla had successfully fought off Latham's demand for daily updates, however, arguing that if Mabbott's plans to find Melville were to work, he should be free to follow leads as and when they came up. Mabbott had reiterated her point, saying he had to be as light on his feet as possible, and presenting Latham with an appearance of calm confidence. It had seemed so easy in London. Now that he was in India, he felt a lot less sure of himself.
"Mr. Keith, sir."
By now, Mabbott had retrieved his luggage, worked his way through the crowd at the exit, and found himself standing before a tall, moustachioed, slightly stooping man with thick glasses, a dark blue tie, and an immaculate white shirt tucked into freshly pressed chinos. Mabbott felt uncomfortable. His shirt was damp and sweaty, and the light cotton trousers he'd chosen for a pre-monsoon climate were already corrugated at the crotch. The man stepped forward and hung a garland of marigolds around Mabbott's hot neck. Then he stepped back, brought his hands together, and gave a short bow.
"Namaste."
"Namaste," replied Mabbott, returning the bow as instructed in his Lonely Planet guide. His companion spread out his arms to encompass the throng of meeters and greeters.
"Welcome, sir, to paradise on earth."
He snapped an order, and a frail, elderly man in a dhoti appeared and took hold of Mabbott's suitcase.
"You can wheel it,"
Mabbott called after him, but it was too late. Their man had already hoiked the case up onto his head and was sprinting towards the exit. The moustachioed man bowed again.
"I am your guide from the Garden Hotel, Bhubaneswar's premier establishment for the discerning visitor. I am here to attend to your every need."
Mabbott controlled an impulse to remonstrate, but it was too late. His companion stepped to one side with another low bow, ushering Mabbott ahead of him, as if the days of the Raj had never ended. On the way in from the airport, as green paddy fields and stagnant creeks slipped by on either side, Mabbott learnt that his guide was called Farood, and that his field of expertise was Hindu temple architecture from the 6th to the 12th century.
"At one time there were 17,000 temples here."
Mabbott nodded. He suddenly felt very weary.
"It is our good fortune that there are still 500 remaining."
As they drew up outside the hotel, three turbaned men stepped forward and grasped the doors. Short of having his name shouted out, Mabbott could hardly have effected a less discreet arrival. Once check-in was completed and further garlands and welcoming drinks had been taken, Mabbott was escorted to a room on the 11th floor and shown at some length how everything from the television to the trouser press worked. When at last he was left alone, he locked his door and lay down on the bed. Sometime later, after an hour's sleep and a shower, Mabbott wandered downstairs for a beer. Farood sprang up from a chair and intercepted him eagerly.
"Sir, shall we go? It is a little cooler now. This is a very good time for the temples."
Look, Farood, it's been a long trip from London and I'm quite tired. Maybe tomorrow would be a better time to see the temples."
Farood adjusted his glasses and extended a hand towards the door.
"But there are many to see. It is best to start now, please."
Sensing that it might be best to maintain the guise of a tourist, Mabbott acquiesced. The first of the six temples they saw that afternoon was 1500 years old and undeniably beautiful. The walls were covered with lively likenesses of musicians, dancers, elephants, gods and goddesses, all in their own little panels. Mabbott would have been quite happy just to follow his guide's footsteps, but Farood would have none of this. He was a master of the interactive.
"Do you know how many gods and goddesses we have in the Hindu religion?"
Mabbott's tired brain ran through the names he'd mugged up during the flight.
10, 12? 350 million.
Ah,
every single family has its own gods, you see.
Farood then explained that the temple they were in was one of the first to be built when Buddhism was overthrown by resurgent Hinduism in the 5th and 6th centuries.
You would think that Buddhism and Hinduism were very different, would you not, sir?
Mabbott dutifully took the bait.
Yes, I would.
Well, you would be wrong. At that time they were very close to each other. In fact, many people believed Buddhism to be a part of Hinduism, so when they converted to Hinduism, they built temples for their Buddhist statues.
Right.
So where did they keep their statues before that, sir?
In their homes.
Farood threw him a look of scorn. No, under the trees.
Mabbott couldn't help noticing the absence of any other white visitors on the temple circuit. This didn't trouble him immediately. If anything, it added to the feeling that, despite a sense of almost dizzying weariness, he was seeing something new and wonderful, and very different from anything the rest of his life spent entirely west of Suez had prepared him for. At the same time, he realized that it was not going to be easy to be inconspicuous. Occasionally he cast furtive glances around him, as if at any moment Hamish Melville might come striding into view. He feared that if the great man sensed the presence of another Englishman, he would vanish forever. The afternoon wore on, and Farood continued his erudite and expansive explanations of the evolution of the Jagamohana, the Natia and Bogomandirs, and various other elements of Hindu architecture.
"And the trident on top of the tower, sir, what does that signify?"
"That we are near the coast?"
Farood swung his head from side to side with delight.
"No, it is the temple of Shiva, the creator. And if it were a temple of Vishnu, what would appear up there?"
"An elephant?"
"No, if it were Vishnu, the symbol would be a wheel."
"I think I should get back to the hotel, Farood. I must make a call to London before it gets too late,"
Mabbott lied, wearying of being the foil.
"It will be 11 o'clock in the night in the UK.
"Yes, and I must tell my wife I've arrived safely,"
he lied again.
"Aha!"
Farood winked conspiratorially.
"The wife, of course."
The next morning, Mabbott slept off some of his jet lag, and, having deferred Farood until late afternoon, he set to work on a plan of action. Matching all the information he gleaned in the last hectic week in London with the various leads he collected from Rex Nasmyth, everything seemed to point to a nondescript guest house that was said to be Melville's base in the city. But when Mabbott showed Farood the address, the man's face darkened, and he shook his head.
"This is not a good place, Mr. Keith. This is far from the airport. Many poor people stay here."
"Well, I'd like to see it. A friend recommended it."
Farood nodded obligingly, but the look in his eyes spoke volumes. They set off in the late afternoon. The shiny white Toyota 4x4 supplied by Farood's company seemed increasingly out of place as they left the wide boulevards of the city and bounced across railway tracks into a labyrinth of narrow, twisting back streets. Bodies spilled around the car. Mabbott had never seen so many people on the street. The only comparison he could think of was the Holloway Road on a night when Arsenal were playing at home, except that these crowds were not on their way to anywhere else. This was where they lived. There was no elevated sense of excitement urging them on. If anything, the common emotion was resignation. Faces stared into the windows, their eyes unblinking and vacant.
"Where are all these people coming from, Farood?"
"They are always here, Mr. Keith. Coming and going, you know. This is a very poor area."
They moved deeper into the old part of town, their driver, like all the other drivers, leaning on his horn adding his contribution to the constant, discordant cacophony of the street. It was not a cacophony of complaint or even of purpose, just an acknowledgement of a shared existence. Children squeezed between their parents, sitting two or three to a motorbike. Stooped old women moving at a snail's pace. Boys with a dozen egg boxes on their heads. Meandering cows, skins stretched tight across spiky haunches. All were given their space on the road. And despite the noise of all the horns, no one seemed to get out of anyone else's way. Nothing had quite prepared Mabbutt for this. It was the India he had heard and read about, but now it was real. He found it exhilarating and alarming at the same time. For what seemed like hours, the Toyota inched its way through endless narrow bazaars until Novan, the driver, a large, broad-shouldered, endlessly patient man, pointed out an arched gateway set a little way back from the road and quite incongruous among the shacks selling fruit, wicker baskets, and gleaming piles of pots and pans. Hotel Farhan, Foodings and Lodgings, read the faded sign above the entrance. Beneath it had been painted, more recently, P. Singh, prop. Nirvan swung the wheel, blasted his horn one last time, and passed between cracked and mildewed pillars into a small courtyard. A black cockerel strutted irritably across their path. Farood was not at all comfortable. He registered his displeasure by being even more curt than usual with Nirvan, who could clearly have felled him with one blow had he so wished.
"Stop here, not here, there, by the door."
The building now occupied by the Hotel Farhan had clearly been around for a while. It was almost square, with a shallow pitched roof, stone walls trimmed with laterite, and rooms on three floors. Indeed, its proportions were not unlike those of a Georgian rectory. The windows on the lower level were shuttered and barred. Between them was a doorway of surprisingly elegant design, with stuccoed columns on either side. From it emerged a tall man, light of colour, with a grey military moustache and a shiny bald head. He wore steel-rimmed glasses and was naked to the waist. He looked with some disdain at the car, its driver and its passengers. Mabbutt felt embarrassed and wished he'd asked Farood to drop him outside in the street, where their approach would have seemed less invasive, but it was too late for that. Farood got out and talked to the man, wobbling his head a lot and glancing over at Mabbutt. Then he climbed back into the car, shut the door, and wound up the window. He looked serious, and when he spoke it was in a strange and formal tone, like a policeman advising someone of their rights.
"Sir Keith, if it is your wish to stay here, there is a room free. It will be 200 rupees a night. There is water and a toilet close to the room. They do not have a cook. He is gone."
He nodded in the direction of the bony proprietor.
"But he will make some food for you. He speaks a little English."
Mabbutt was confused, and more than a little dubious. He rooted about in his notebook to check the address he'd been given.
"This is 28 Awanati Road?"
The driver nodded. Time seemed to stand still for a moment. The proprietor waited in the shade of the doorway, flicking away flies with a cotton towel. A dog appeared in the yard, but fiercely, then collapsed on the ground, panting with the effort. Mabbutt knew they were all waiting for his decision. The sensible course of action would be to return to the Garden Hotel and start again, yet the name and the address matched what he'd been given. And he had to start somewhere. He looked again at the dingy yard, with the emaciated dog and the strutting black cockerel and the pile of paper and dust half swept into a corner.
"Tell him I'll take the room."
Chapter 2. Mabbutt unpacked his things, and finding nowhere to put them, packed them away again. Apart from a low bed with slightly damp sheets, the furniture in his room was limited to a chair, a small table stabilised by wedges of tightly folded newspaper, and a chest of drawers, with no drawers in it. A bulky aircon unit above the door burst into action and shuddered to a halt at frequent intervals, as if it were trying to cough something up. After a while, Mabbutt turned it off, and relied instead on a wooden-bladed ceiling fan that swirled silently, languidly, and largely ineffectively. To combat the disorientation he felt, he took out his notebook and began to write down everything that had happened to him since his arrival in India. When he finally looked up from his work, it was evening. Farood had returned to his office, so Mabbott decided to take a walk in the thronged street outside the hotel. The air smelt of spice and incense and dung. Scooters fizzed around him, motorized rickshaws snarled their way through, an occasional gaudily decorated truck pushed past, horn blasting, while cows emerged from side streets, wandering into the thick of it all with serene indifference. A bicycle bell clanged behind Mabbott, and he quickly stepped aside to avoid being impaled on the 6-foot lengths of steel piping slung across the handlebars. Once he'd accepted the confusion, Mabbott began to feel oddly safe and comfortable. The rough and tumble of humanity offered its own sense of security. Then a sudden sharp cry from farther up the street cut through the ambient noise. Mabbott stood on tiptoe, craning his neck for a better view. A crowd was converging on a tilted auto rickshaw. He could hear shouts, raised voices, people thumping the roof of the vehicle. He half walked, half ran to join the group of onlookers. Anger and argument filled the air as arms were raised and fists clenched. Apportioning blame seemed to be more important than helping the injured. A woman lay moaning on the ground. Beside her, a young man in shirt and jeans was cowering from the blows and kicks that were raining down on his body. Some bystanders were making an attempt to pull away the assailants, and Mabbott pushed forward to join them. As he did so, he felt a tight pressure on his arm and heard a soft but authoritative voice.
"Don't get involved."
Mabbott wheeled round to find himself being gently but firmly led away from the scene